Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
Welcome into Legal Face Off here, the final episode of June. The Legal Eagles are here. Rich Linkoff, Tina Martini. My name is Sam Paniadovich. Ben Anderson is behind the glass. Is this still 50 degrees in June, or is it like 65 today? What's with this
October
weather?
October or June?
Weatherman Lankov, what's going on here? WGN softball keeps getting canceled because of weather.
I think we need to interview Tom Skilling about this.
I think we should do a lot of things on the show today.
Are you back on GN softball?
Oh, yeah. We're good. You guys should come out one night. You're invited.
I'd love to. Hopefully.
Definitely should. We'll talk about pot impaired driving.
16 in softball for our listeners, right?
Yes. Yeah. No gloves.
No just gloves. That's ball. A Chicago way.
The clincher. So we'll talk about pot impaired driving, Rich's favorite topic. We'll talk about obesity, and we'll also have our legal grab bag at the end of the show. But before we get anything else done, let's reintroduce Kim Goldman, a return guest here on Legal Face Off. You know her. She is Ron Goldman's sister, also an advocate, a writer, a mother. She calls herself a friend, a daughter, a hockey, a basketball, and a football fan, among many things. But Kim, your newest endeavor is a podcast called Confronting O.J. Simpson. Welcome back to Legal Face Off.
For having me.
Kim, it's been 25 years since your brother Ron was tragically murdered. Why did you decide to revisit the case with your podcast?
I for a very long time, I've listened to everybody else tell a story, tell their version of a story that they think people want to hear. We've listened to a lot of versions that involve fiction. So I think for me, it was just kind of reclaiming control over something that's been out of control and telling it from a different perspective than I think we've heard before, because it's me and there are people that I know and more intimate kind of conversations, I think.
So, Kim, what do you want listeners to learn about your brother and the case that they didn't already know?
Well, about my brother specifically, I think that, the very first episode is pretty gut-wrenching. It goes back to our childhood. We grew up in Chicago and Buffalo Grove, so we talked to some of his friends from junior high and high school. I really wanted people to get a well-rounded view of who my brother was and who he meant to so many people. But for the show itself, I think I want people just to understand the devastating effects that this case has had on everybody involved 25 years later, to understand what went into various decisions, whether it was putting on specific pieces of evidence or testimony, to not putting them on, to juror discussions, expert witnesses, media, brief experts. I mean, I want people to take away something that they don't think that they've read or seen before.
Kim, it's interesting because I was listening to our last podcast this morning a couple of weeks ago, and we had on the parents of one of the Aurora, Colorado theater shooting victims, and they were talking about their efforts to limit notoriety of mass shooters, keep them out of the media. You've been very vocal in not referring to O.J. Simpson by his name, but rather you've called him the killer, the murdering liar. Yet he continues to be, very prominent. And in fact, he is in the title of your podcast. Explain to our listeners how you've been dealing with him over the last 25 years and this dichotomy of course, using his name to keep the memory of your brother and the stories you want to tell alive, but also not wanting to give this individual, O.J. Simpson, continued fame and notoriety.
Wow, that's a really good question. So I struggle with that, to be honest with you, because the choice to call him killer is my own. I can call him by his name. I think people think I'm going to self-combust if I call him by his name. I just choose not to, because I think calling him by his name is a little too casual and too familiar. For a very long time, it used to frustrate me that anchors, news people would just refer to him by his first name as if they were beer drinking buddies, and it just annoyed me. And so sitting in court one day with Dominic Dunn, who was a friend and a fellow victim, kind of said to me, well, he's a killer. That's what we should be calling him. And I said, yes, that's exactly right. So that's what it was. But the purpose of the show is that this is the first season, and this is the story that we're confronting. Next season, it's going to be a different name. I don't necessarily have a problem calling perpetrators by their name. I can appreciate both sides of it. I just always want to make sure people understand and remember the brutality in which people died. I think we've become pretty desensitized to how much violence we have in the world. So I'm kind of all over the place on it, to be honest with you.
Which is understandable. I mean, obviously understandable. I mean, it's yeah. something you've been dealing with for so many years, and obviously, you know, very, very difficult situation.
Kim, you interviewed several key people involved with the trial of the century in your podcast, including prosecutor Marcia Clark and Cato Kalin. What mm-hmm. insight have these guests brought?
You know, I think for me, specifically with Cato, for example, I think a lot of people, you know, found him to be such a goofball and to not take it seriously. And I had been harboring some anger, I think, for a while towards him because I thought, you know, you're involved in this enormous case, you know, take it more seriously, stop goofing around up there. I mean, that was what my impression was. And so when I spoke to him, we talked about that and about how scared he was and how intimidating this whole process was. And I don't think folks understand when you're in a courtroom, you know, when you have a jury and you have a prosecutor and a judge and the camera and the defendant, and it's scary. And I think he was nervous. I think Marcia was mad that he wasn't, in her mind, revealing information that he supposedly said in a different conversation, in a different testimony. So I think there's some understanding there as to why each of them felt the way they did. I go back to, I want people to understand how this impacts people. I mean, Cato specifically, you know, he hibernated for a year or so after this case because of the death threats and the harassment and the stalking, you know, and he was just a guy living on the property who was on the phone with some woman and then banging on the wall, you know, I mean, and there he is now in the midst of this whole thing. And I think, like I said, there's just a level of insight that we haven't heard, I don't think.
Kim, last week, speaking of difficult things that you've dealt with, last week, O.J. Simpson posted a video on Twitter announcing that he created an account. He already has 650,000 followers who will hear his, quote, thoughts and opinions on just about everything. That's how he has, that's what he's promised. Disturbingly, at the end of the video, OJ said, "I've got a little getting even to do." Mm-hmm. I'm sure that elicited a reaction from you and your family.
Yeah, it was alarming. This is part of the anxiety that I feel, knowing that he's, you know, walking the streets. When he was in prison in Las Vegas a handful of years ago for that 9-year break, I was able to breathe a little bit deeper, and now this is what I'm up against. You know, at any given moment, he has the freedom to say and do whatever he wants, and I get that, but it does interrupt my flow. It does cause me pause. It's upsetting, and he refers to himself as yours truly, and he chuckles, and it's just this brazen kind of arrogance. And at the end of the day, two people are still dead. Whether or not you think it was him, he doesn't go on there and talk about the loss. He doesn't talk about his innocence. He talks about football, I mean, you know, and fantasy football, or advice his mama gave him. I mean, like, it's just weird to me. But you know, I guess to each his own, and people aren't responding too positively towards him, I don't think.
Kim, I'm fascinated by your discussions with the jurors. I haven't heard that part yet. But, you know, when I watched the interviews with the jurors in the ESPN documentary, I was struck by basically their admission in that documentary that they ignored evidence of O.J. Simpson's guilt as mm-hmm. a means of getting back for the Rodney King situation. I found that, mm-hmm. you know, I knew that, we heard that, but I found it shocking to hear these people say that. It's really impressive that you spoke to them. What was your takeaway from your discussion with the jurors who acquitted O.J. Simpson?
I think, honestly, those were probably the more difficult conversations out of all the ones I had. I think we were all a little bit nervous going into that. I appreciate that they were willing to sit down with me. That could not have been easy. But neither gentleman that I spoke with backed down. They both, you know, were pretty committed to their decision. One of them in particular kind of confirmed what I always thought, and that's just that they stopped listening, that they wanted to go home. They were tired of being there. They were resentful that they were sequestered. And that 3.5-hour deliberation window was a farce. That's the only thing he apologized to me for, which was wasting that time and not really deliberating and giving the case its proper due. But they already had their minds made up, and he confirmed that.
Kim, you are a tremendously positive force in your community as a victims advocate, among other work you do. Can you share with our listeners some of the other work that you do on behalf of others?
Thank you for asking. My everyday job, which I'm taking a break from today, is I run a nonprofit organization called The Youth Project, and I provide free mental health to teenagers 12 to 18. Our kids are dealing with depression and suicide and domestic violence and sexual assaults, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I've been doing that since 2005. I also am the vice chair for the National Center of Victims of Crime, and I volunteer on a multitude of other boards and organizations that work with sexual assault survivors and domestic violence and some of the families from the Aurora shooting. So I really just try to be as involved as I can, and I'm a mom to a 15-year-old kid, and that's a full-time job. And so, I'm doing my best every day.
Kim, we learn something new about you every day. Obviously, we know about the books. You're a best-selling author, New York Times. But you have some ties here to Chicagoland, or at least their teams. Bulls and Blackhawks fan? How did this come about?
Because I grew up in Chicago. So I didn't come into sports until a little bit later. I'm wearing my Chicago Bulls shirt right now. Being a mom to a teenager, my kid loves basketball. So he's been a Bulls fan since the time he could say basketball. I don't know. It's just my love of sports. And in the last couple of years, I've become a football fan, too. So I'm busy.
That is Kim Goldman, at Kim E. Goldman on Twitter, and the podcast Confronting O.J. Simpson. The handle there, at Confronting Pod. Kim, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery, and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell, and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
You can listen to Legal Face-Off on iTunes. You can also like the show on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. Rich Lankoff, Tina Martini. My name is Sam Panionovich. Joining us now, the Sheriff of Sangamon County, Illinois, Jack Campbell, who is also the Program Director of the Medical Cannabis Pilot Program in the state. And Sheriff, we're going to talk about some pot-impaired driving. Welcome to WGN Radio.
Well, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to it.
Sheriff, as we all know, recreational use of marijuana is expected to be legal in Illinois as of January 1st, 2020. You testified in front of the legislature on behalf of the Illinois Sheriff's Association, asking them to slow down the process. Why?
Well, first and foremost, public safety is our main concern, and there are not the components in place yet for law enforcement to protect our roadways, to protect our citizens. And the first one would be an admissible field test. We all know about the field sobriety, the walk and, touch your nose and everything. In Illinois, there's nothing right now to help us with just pure impairment of cannabis, and that concerns us at the Sheriff's Association.
So are there any other types of tests other than field sobriety that are contemplated as actually being able that we could actually get to a place where they're workable in the field?
Well, right now there's a roadside test being conducted up in northern Illinois at least one agency to check for with a swab the nanogram level of THC in your system, which is a psychoactive ingredient. But it's not yet perfected, and it's not admissible in Illinois courts. So the only thing left for us to do is, absent an accident where they're going to get a blood draw at the hospital, is to go get a warrant to get a blood draw to check that level of THC in your system. And again, it hasn't been established yet in Illinois what is the impairment level. So those are our concerns that we wanted the legislature to get that component in place before they passed the bill.
go ahead.
Other than the issue with actually testing people in the field, what other challenges does marijuana pose that are different from alcohol risks?
Well, under the current bill they passed, some of our challenges are the mass expungement of records, you know, the home grow component. Even though the sponsors did alter the bill and just have medical patients have the only ones that can home grow, but in my line of work in law enforcement, what we will see is an abuse of that. In that, let's say a 78-year-old grandmother is a patient that has cancer. She probably is not going to grow cannabis in her basement, but if she has a family member, somebody next door that knows that she has the card, they may go down in her basement and grow cannabis, and it's going to create a new gray market or another black market for cannabis coming from those houses, and law enforcement won't have the ability to go in and inspect those homes. So that's our concern, that there's just not going to be the control that we saw in the other medical program that I was in charge of. Jeff.
Sheriff, a lot of people perceive marijuana as less dangerous than alcohol when it comes to driving. There have been some studies that show that the level of marijuana when combined, or the level of impairment when combining marijuana with other substances like alcohol can spike. Can you talk to our listeners a little bit about that and whether marijuana is in fact dangerous to use while driving?
Well, absolutely. There's no doubt about that marijuana is another mind-altering substance. Certainly, it's a given that alcohol is dangerous. In my career in law enforcement, I fought with a lot of drunks. I don't recall ever fighting with somebody that was high, but that's not the point. The point is that person that's high now could be on our roadways where you and I, our family members, are all out there, and we don't have a way to control that. You know, the states that have legalized cannabis, and typically Colorado is the one that we use as our barometer, have seen increases in traffic fatalities. All reportable crimes have gone up. Homelessness has exploded. All these things are not just, affect our lives every day, but it also is issues that can affect our visitors to our state. They don't want to come in and see this. So I'm really concerned here in Illinois that we'll become the magnet for the Midwest the way Colorado has become the magnet for the West.
Sheriff, there are some features of House Bill 1438 that did aim to remedy some of the things that you're discussing. It included a DOI cannabis task force. It called for 8% of tax revenue generated by sales of recreational marijuana to be distributed to local law enforcement agencies. By some estimates that figure can reach as high as $40 million per year. Do you think still that those are not sufficient measures to deal with your concerns?
No, I don't believe it is. A task force, you know, everybody creates a task force to fix something, but they didn't need a task force to identify these problems. We already told them what the problems were, and you don't have to look for a way to fix it because the other states that already have legalized cannabis are already going through this. The amount of tax revenue that can come in off of this, you know, I promise you that first year or two, everybody will get excited about the money rolling in now. But once it starts going back out in social services and to pay for more law enforcement, because now we have to do more roadside safety checks, we have more crimes going on in our communities, you'll see that money begin to dry up and go out the other end in social services. So I don't think the amount of money that's going to be brought in is going to be enough to counteract the societal cost that we believe is going to happen.
Sheriff, we know the telltale signs of somebody who's impaired with alcohol, right? They start swerving, mm-hmm. They smell, you can see it in their eyes. What are the signs?
They shop for Funyuns.
That's for alcohol. I'm talking for marijuana. What are the telltale signs? What are you looking for when you pull somebody over and you're suspicious about them being impaired with marijuana? What are the telltale signs and what are your keys?
Well, the first one is obviously that the smell or the smoke that may roll out the window. You know, not the cheese and chong type of smoke, but you can detect that odor pretty easily. And then it's going to be the red eyes. It's going to be the slow reactions. You know, there's so many of them that do mimic alcohol. You generally are not going to get the violence and the anger that you get out of some people that have been drinking. But it's going to be a clear impairment, and they will also be swerving and what have you across the roadway. So it's one of the things that's going to be new to us. Typically now, if we pull somebody over and they're DUI for alcohol, we don't even test them for cannabis. But we know by talking to them that they had smoked joints earlier, and that it probably added to their level of impairment. But we don't continue on with it because there's no sense in it in here in Illinois.
Currently, if you pull someone over today and they show the symptoms that you just described, you cannot use that to get a blood test from them?
Yes, we can develop the probable cause and force them to go to the hospital. We've done a couple what we call non-consensual blood draws on some safety checkpoints with our state's attorney down here in Springfield. But it's not something that we do very often, and it can be controversial. But all that is going to take a deputy off the road for maybe the rest of their shift. If we have to go through all that step to go get a state's attorney, fill out the affidavit for the warrant, go get a judge to sign the warrant, go to the hospital and get the blood draw, not only is it time consuming, but also the level of that THC in their system can begin to go downward. So the more time that goes by, we're going to lose that evidence. It just doesn't make any sense. And given our current climate, I just wish the legislature would have thought this through and listened to us in law enforcement that are out there every day trying to protect our citizens and slowed down this process. But for some reason, they were hell-bent on getting this bill through, and the governor wants to sign it. But we don't believe that you know, it's safe for our citizens.
How far are we away from that field sobriety test or the science involved in testing this on the road?
You know, I don't know that, and clearly we will get to that day. We know that necessity is the mother of invention. It will happen, but it's not ready yet. And that was our wish, is slow it down, make it the next session. Don't do it now. Let's get all this stuff in place. Get our state's attorneys and the courts on board with what you're intending to do on this test, and then pass the bill. But we did it in reverse order, and I hope that it doesn't impact anybody's safety in Illinois.
He is Jack Campbell, Sheriff Sangamon County in Illinois. Sheriff, keep fighting the good fight. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely will. Thank you for the opportunity.
Comp Alliance is unique in the workers' compensation industry in their ability to provide comprehensive managed care services from initiation of a claim to settlement, including 24/7 nurse triage, URAC accredited medical and vocational case management. Their suite of innovative MSP compliance solutions, including fully customizable MSA programs, professional administration, and additional cost avoidance services, simplifies the claims management process. Their focus is retaining accountability, responsiveness, and quality while tailoring their services to meet your needs. For your managed care support needs, contact Comp Alliance online at compalliance.com. Again, compalliance.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off here on WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com. Rich and Tina are here. My name is Sam, and joining us in the studio, she's a partner at Ford Harrison, Kimberly Ross, very familiar with the issue on obesity. There's a lot of letters, though, Ms. Ross, so you have to explain to me. There's the ADA. There's a lot of letters going on here. What exactly have you done, and what was the piece that you just penned?
I drafted an amicus brief in support of the position of the Chicago Transit Authority in the case of Richardson versus the Chicago Transit Authority. On the issue of ADA, and where the alphabet soup continues, is that it also related to interpretations of the amendments to the ADA from 2008, which are known as the ADAAA, which is much easier to just say the amendments to the ADA.
And you wrote it on behalf of the IADTC.
Correct. The Illinois Association of Defense Trial Counsel, which is easier to say as IDC.
Got it.
So, Kimberly, earlier this month, the Seventh Circuit issued its ruling in the case that you just mentioned, Richardson versus Chicago Transit Authority, where the court agreed with prior decisions in several other circuits and upheld the dismissal of the case, which had been brought based on the premise that obesity is an impairment under the ADA. So in the case, the Seventh Circuit found that obesity does not constitute an impairment under the ADA unless there's evidence of an underlying physiological cause. Can you please tell our listeners a little bit more about this case and what the plaintiff was trying to prove and how the court ended up reaching its decision?
Sure. There were essentially two issues in the case. The first was whether obesity in and of itself, in the absence of an underlying physiological cause, was considered to be an ADA impairment. No need for any medical information, but simply based on two physical characteristics of height and weight to somehow define a condition of obesity, whether those two things would automatically deem a person to have an ADA impairment. The second aspect of it was whether this particular plaintiff was regarded as disabled. In other words, did his employer perceive him to have a disability? And the court issued its rulings on both of those arguments.
So just give our listeners a little context, because this was the plaintiff in this case was a driver for the CTA named Mark Richardson, and he was sent for a safety assessment after returning from a lengthy medical leave. And he was required to undergo the assessment because he weighed over 400 pounds. The driver's seat were designed to only hold 400 pounds. And during this assessment, he was unable to do many of the activities involved in this position. And he therefore, as you mentioned, argued that under the ADA, his obesity should qualify as an impairment without having to show the underlying physiological cause. So why did the group that you work with, the IADTC, get involved, and what were you trying to explain in your brief?
My involvement came in order to draft the employer's perspective on this case. So of course, we weren't involved in the specific issues that the CTA was involved in, but being an amicus drafter, we were able to make additional arguments that we felt the court should hear. So I drafted it from the perspective of an employer and the common sense result that a decision would have on the average employer should obesity be deemed to be an ADA impairment with nothing further.
And that common sense conclusion included the fact that if he won, you would have to consider about 40% of the American adult population who are obese, according to the definition of obesity, and therefore they would have ADA impairment protection.
Correct. It would severely overburden employers to automatically, immediately have employees be considered, have 40% of the workforce be considered to have an ADA impairment, which then sets in motion what's called the interactive process that employers have to go through when they have employees with ADA impairments or potentially with ADA impairments to determine whether there are any reasonable accommodations that could be given that would allow the employee to perform the essential functions of the job. The difficulty here would be that it would be this, that obesity as defined that in a way that employers can use is based on nothing more than two physical characteristics, height and weight, which would then make employers have to look at its employees, make judgments as to how much the employee weighs and how tall they are, and then assume that if they are obese, meaning that they have a BMI of 30 or more, that they might be needing some sort of accommodation to perform their job. What's important to remember that is that in the facts of this Richardson case, he wasn't asking for any accommodations to perform the functions of his job. What was found was that as a 600-pound bus driver, there were certain physical maneuvers that he was required to be able to perform in order to do his job safely, and he wasn't able to do those because of his actual size, not because of his inability to, say, move his arms or move his legs. He didn't ask for any accommodations. He said he didn't need any accommodations, and he could perform the essential functions of his job. But what the average employee would be asking for could potentially be accommodations based on nothing more than somebody's physical size, like two seats on an airplane or a larger company car versus reinforced furniture, like a stronger chair, something of that nature.
So let's talk for a minute about obesity. It is considered a disease. What is the distinction here between an impairment under the ADA versus a disease? Can you explain for our listeners what the interplay is there and what the distinction is?
Well, I think that there's actually, it's not entirely settled that obesity is a disease, or at least in terms of one that automatically means that somebody has an impairment. Not like cancer can be defined or Parkinson's disease can be defined from a medical perspective. There's really no medically accepted across-the-board definition of obesity. And as evidenced by the terminology that the plaintiff himself used in his appellate brief, he referred to his condition for everything from obese to extremely obese to severely obese to morbidly obese, because there really is no perfect definition of it. What's important to take away here is that this ruling did not say that obese individuals will have no protection under the ADA. All this ruling says is that an obese individual is not automatically deemed to have an ADA impairment. If the person's obesity causes causes other issues such as high blood pressure or arthritis or joint pain, those conditions may be ADA impairments that need to be go through the interactive process to determine whether they need to be accommodated.
Or if the obesity is caused by another condition.
Certainly. If the obesity is caused by an underlying physiological condition, then in and of itself it is an ADA impairment, which would then have to go through the process with the employer to determine if there's an accommodation that can be given.
So the burden, of course, in that case is on the plaintiff to show why, or the source of their obesity, right? That it was a physiological condition. I mean, that seems to be getting a little into their private lives, right?
If the plaintiff wants to take the position that the obesity should be accommodated in by itself, then yes, they're going to have to provide medical evidence that it was caused by an underlying physiological condition. But what's interesting is that the majority of obesity is not caused by underlying physiological conditions. And in fact, when you turn to the second aspect of the ruling, which had to do with whether this particular plaintiff was regarded as or perceived as disabled, you get into the issue of what the underlying cause of this employee's disability was. And what the court said in a nice and concise statement was that in order for the plaintiff to prove that the employer regarded him as being disabled, he would have to prove that the employer perceived that his obesity was caused by an underlying physiological condition or disorder, not just that the employee had an impairment, a physical impairment. And therefore, the plaintiff would have to show first that the employer even considered the cause of the employee's obesity, which most employers probably wouldn't. And second, that proving that the employer thought that it was because of some rare underlying medical condition, like perhaps a brain tumor or a thyroid disorder, versus the more commonly known cause of obesity, which has to do with diet and a lack of exercise, it's a pretty stiff burden for a plaintiff to now prove that he was regarded as disabled under this standard. And the way this Seventh Circuit court stated it was nice and concise, where it had been a little bit more wishy-washy in other prior decisions.
That is Kimberly Ross, a partner at Ford Harrison. Thank you so much for coming in, and we hope to do it again soon.
Thank you.
Rich Lenkoff is an insurance defense attorney with Bryce Downey & Lenkoff. Rich is consistently recognized by clients for his outstanding litigation results. In 2015, Target named him their top outside litigation attorney in the country. Rich has received a number of industry accolades, including Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 through 2018 and Leading Lawyer from 2012 through 2018, designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, including serving on the Lincoln Park High School Local School Council, the Advisory Board of Legal Prep Charter Academy, and the Board of Visitors for the Northern Illinois University College of Law. In addition to his full-time legal practice, Rich is a producer with credits, including 85, the greatest team in football history, starring former President Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka, and Renegades, a live show production at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon. In addition to co-hosting Legal Faceoff since 2013, Rich is the legal analyst for several WGN shows, including The Bill and Wendy Show and Patty Vasquez with Andrea Darlis. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional liability, business transactions, construction law, and intellectual property. For more information about Rich and Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, please visit bdlfirm.com.
It is time for the legal grab bag here on Legal Faceoff. We round it out every single time we do this show. Rich Lenkoff, Tina Martini. My name is Sam Panionovich. Thanks to Ben Anderson. Joining us in the studio today, a man who is, I guess he bleeds WGN Radio. Michael Heidemann from the Steve Cochran Show. Hello.
Hey, it's great to be here.
No stranger to Legal Faceoff either.
No, sirree.
Our first ever producer.
That's right. And I came back. Everything's full circle right now.
Heidemann.
I love it.
An OG.
Yeah.
An OG to LFO.
An OG LFOer.
Very long list of producers on this show.
It's good to be back. I'm glad the team is nice and rocking in full force today.
Also, falling back to the bottom of the podcast world is Michael Heidemann. We appreciate it.
Matt Pollack joining us too in studio, Director of Communications and Technology at the Chicago Volunteer Legal Services, CVLS.org. Matt, welcome.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So we throw you right on the spot, and how fitting, Rich. Let's start with war crimes. All right. Of our seven topics, we start with war crimes today.
That's a very gregarious opening to a war crime story. Yeah, we've covered a couple of war crime stories. They seem to be more prevalent. But last week, there was an explosive development in a trial in San Diego involving Chief Edward Eddie Gallagher, who was the head of a SEAL team crew that was deployed in Iraq. And he was on trial for the murder of a detainee. And the trial was going along, and the accusation was that while this teenager, who was a part of the Islamic State, was a prisoner, that Gallagher stabbed him and killed him while in custody. Well, the explosive part was that another individual on Thursday morning in the San Diego courtroom, where Special Warfare Operator First Class Corey Scott admitted that he was the one who actually killed this young man. He said that while Gallagher did stab the individual, that it was Scott who actually killed him by covering up this tube that he was breathing through. Now, the individual who admitted to this crime had immunity from prosecution. And there's a lot of discussion about whether he, in fact, was the one who killed him, whether he was trying to help him, whether he only took the blame for Gallagher because he had this immunity deal. In the wake of this, President Trump said that he may pardon this individual once the trial is over. There's been some talk of pardons in other similar stories that we've covered, but really interesting development. Of course, it brings to mind the question of whether rights of habeas corpus, whether rights to trial, whether these kind of killings are justified in the time of war. Of course, this person said that he did so out of national security because this, you know, this individual was a risk to safety. What do you all think? Number one, what do you think of this idea that in a war, we still are in a war, that these kind of things are permissible? Tina?
Well, I mean, there are certain rules, and I know we've covered this previously on other shows, that there are certain rules that sort of dictate and govern even times of war. And we need to make sure that we're mindful of that. And also, I can see the other side of it too, that when you're in a situation like that, it's really hard for us to make rules before we're in a situation like that. But, you know, with the stress and with survival and all the other considerations that go into a time of war, sometimes it's really difficult to be making these decisions, although there's a framework in place. So, but at the end of the day, I think that there are rules in place for a reason.
Yeah, Mike, this guy has received a lot of sympathy, obviously, for people who are sympathetic to the idea that, you know, he did what he thought was right for national security. Of course, as Tina mentioned, there are rules in place, right? I mean, there are rules in place for prisoners who are detained. The chief reason being you don't want foreign governments treating Americans the way that you might treat a foreign detainee in our country.
Exactly. Yeah, it's clearly an ethical issue. I mean, it's like Tina explained, just going through these difficult times with war, rules are often bent, and now you need to go back and look at how you're going to regulate and justify these things that are happening during the most stressful time in a person's life, in a country's life. And it's hard to see, you know, where the black and white line lies with these kind of war crimes, as they say. So this is an interesting story. I didn't hear about this until I was reading and prepping for the show, but just hearing about how, you know, you're justifying somebody who is stabbed and then on his deathbed is being, you know, they're trying to save him by going through more torture by cutting his life short. So where does the line lay, and what is the right decision? And I'm glad I don't have to be on that court to make that choice, because it's very, very it's a very serious circumstance.
No doubt. Matt, you're on the hot seat. Your thoughts on topic number one?
Well, I kind of agree with everybody that obviously that there are, you know, times of war and you get stressed and, you know, things happen really quickly. But we have been dealing with this, I think, basically since we got into Afghanistan, right? What is appropriate and when can you turn a blind eye to maybe someone did something that may not be exactly by the books, but it's still kind of above board? This seems to be kind of different. One, basically the Scott, Corey Scott, the guy who admitted to plugging up the air hole, he fully admitted that he also saw this Gallagher stab the kid, and they never really mentioned why he stabbed the kid. Because it seemed to me that Scott was the one trying to prevent the kid from being tortured by the Iraqi security officials, and Gallagher was not mentioned in saving him any kind of pain or suffering. He just stabbed the guy and walked off. So that's kind of questioning, but I know that there's also two sides, because I'm sure there's other things we haven't heard. But it's just very, very interesting. I think at the end of the day, we do have to kind of have some kind of moral code. Otherwise, what's the point of us being there? You know, if it's just at the end of the day, us versus them, then that's not really, I mean, that's just who has the bigger guns. But if you're going to be morally superior and like, yes, we don't kill our, you know, detainees, that's why we're, you know, supposed to be the USA.
Right.
I can't believe it's been almost 7 years since the Sandy Hook shooting. In December 2012, I feel like that was one of the first big topics we covered when we started Legal Face-Off back in 2014, because there was a lot of fallout. Tina, even more fallout. Now we have a defamation lawsuit involving one of the fathers of one of the victims.
Yes. Well, it's hard to believe that this is the case, but this lawsuit was brought by a father of a six-year-old that was killed in the shooting, against the authors of a book that actually claims that the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting never happened, which is a topic that we have previously covered on this show. So Lenny Posner's six-year-old son, Noah, was killed at Sandy Hook, and he brought the lawsuit against the authors of the book Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. The book has actually also been pulled from shelves.
That's the actual title of the book.
Yes, right? It's the actual title of the book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook.
Mm.
It's hard to believe. The book is actually also due to an independent set of claims against the book's publisher. The book has actually been pulled from the shelves as well. Later this year, there will be a trial to decide on damages in this case. Unfortunately, Posner for years has been the subject of many death threats and harassments by various people who claim that Sandy Hook was a hoax. He's worked for years with Facebook and others to remove conspiracy videos and to set up a website to try to debunk various conspiracy theories. Posner's the lead plaintiff in at least 9 cases now that have been filed against various individuals who deny that Sandy Hook happened. And these cases are pending in Connecticut, Florida, Texas, and Wisconsin. Alex Jones, who we've talked about previously on the show, is the host of the conspiracy-driven site InfoWars and is in the middle of a number of these lawsuits. There's been some very outrageous behavior that has been attributed to Jones as part of these cases, including allegations that as part of the discovery process in one case, when he sent over electronic files to respond to Discover, he sent child pornography among some of the electronic files. And also there's been allegations that his followers have subjected the families of 8 of the victims and a first responder to harassment and death threats. So, you know, these cases are going to keep this in the news probably for a while.
Guys, there is First Amendment rights, and then there's, you know, what this is, which I consider far outside the bounds of the First Amendment. It's hate speech and it's defamatory. And the court, thankfully, in Wisconsin agreed with that. Do you think there should be unlimited ability to claim things like this, or do you think there should be some limits? Jump in anyway.
I say, no, that's just stupid. It just is. I mean, just dumb, you can't yell fire in a theater, too. So, I mean, this is just the same thing. And I think in the article, the father was mentioning, like, sometimes he feels hunted because of these you know, yeah, rabid followers.
He's had to move 6 times.
Yeah, this Alex Jones, you know, went on there and had all these rabid followers going after this poor guy and his family and everyone he knows. And so, I mean, just sick. That's just disgusting.
It's crazy to think that this is the world that we live in. And this is, you know, the internet brings a lot of good and it brings a lot of bad. And this is one of the bad things that it brings, where all these conspiracy theorists can kind of rise to the top with the amount of people that follow them. And it's crazy to think that somebody would write a book about this, believe this, and then harass and go out of his way to harass this individual who went through the toughest moment of his life with Posner's or going through these kind of things. It reminds me of that one time when because growing up, you'd see only a few things. It'd be the moon landing was the hoax. And I remember there was this author who went up to Buzz Aldrin and he said, "This the moon landing's a hoax. Why don't you just admit it? Admit it." And Buzz Aldrin punched him right in the face. Does anybody remember that viral video that happened a while back? And it's like, where is the line? Like, there needs to be set rules with Facebook, with publishing books, because there are a lot of weak-willed people out there who believe this kind of stuff. And it's like people like Milo who wrote that really inflammatory book. I can't remember. The name was very offensive, but he was taken off his publisher's writing list. He can't put out any more books. He was taken off Facebook, and there needs to be like a big brother that says what you're doing is wrong and it needs to stop, or else everyone is just going to keep following suit.
Well, and good for the Sandy Hook families. I mean, we have covered some legislation that they've been proponents of on this show. We've had a lot of them on, and through lawsuits like this one, they're being a lot more aggressive in pursuing their rights. I think that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's just really sad that Posner unfortunately has felt the need to like go to the medical examiner and get DNA samples to prove that his son died. Like, it isn't horrific enough.
The certificate isn't enough.
To prove that your son existed.
Yeah. Yes, and that he was actually, you know, in the medical examiner's office.
It only gets easier from here, I promise. These topics get lighter and lighter as we go on this show. So Joel Brodsky, as many know, the former attorney for Drew Peterson, he has been suspended. No more practicing court.
Yeah, at first he was fined $50,000 back in 2018 by Judge Kendall here in federal court in Chicago, and he was ordered to take ethics training and anger management classes. In the wake of that, he wasn't apparently following those orders because he has now been suspended, which is a incredibly drastic step. The court and the governing body here in Illinois, they will have different levels of censure. They might suspend your license to practice for a few months. There aren't many cases where you are barred from practicing law entirely. In this case, Judge Kendall found that Mr. Brodsky's unprofessional, contemptuous, and antagonistic behavior directed at opposing counsel. Some of this behavior included vitriolic emails to other attorneys. He even accused an expert witness of fabricating a son, talking about, you know, similar to our other story. And again, Judge Kendall referenced the numerous other instances in state court where Brodsky was left unscathed, as she called it, by other sanctions. So the sanctions weren't working, led to this very drastic situation where he's now been barred from practicing law. Tina, you and I have been practicing for a while. We've seen a lot of attorneys behaving badly.
Unfortunately.
Any similar stories to Mr. Brodsky? I've never seen someone get their license suspended, though, for this kind of thing.
You know, it's interesting. I've seen some pretty bad behavior. There's one person that sort of comes to mind that I personally experience. But what I find interesting is that it seems like the ARDC, which is the governing body that you referenced a minute ago, I think it's been an interesting confluence of things. I think people are more likely and inclined to file reports and against attorneys, and I just think that there's less of a tolerance for it, because in this instance there seemed to have been a number of data points. It wasn't just one or two things. It seems like there was a series of data points involving him over time, and they were all collected together to paint the story of what was going on.
Guys, does this underline for you everything that's wrong about the legal profession? Brodsky wrote to one opposing counsel. He said, "How do you even call yourself a lawyer? You're an embarrassment to the profession." When you hear this kind of thing, Michael, are you happy that lawyers who act this way get their comeuppance?
Yes, absolutely. It's crazy to think that it took this many times where he actually needed to get his license revoked. It's like, where does the rubber meet the road? Where does the straw that breaks the camel's back happen with this? Because these are people's lives that he's defending, and the fact that he is in this situation and spouting out these lies, making up, is saying that people are making up sons and all this crazy behavior. He was only fined before this, and then it was just all these steps that needed to go on until he finally was. They're just like, all right, enough is enough. You're done. Like, can this happen a lot?
Well, Matt, you work with Chicago Volunteer Legal Services. Mostly the attorneys that you're working with are acting nice to people. They're actually donating their time.
By definition, we're the good guys.
Okay.
But no, it sounded like this Drew Peterson's lawyer, Brodsky, he was doing these things that he could have been fined for up mm-hmm. until then. They just didn't.
Wow.
So I think that's the point, is that he was just getting off the hook for so many things. He became allegedly a very, shall we say, spoiled attorney, got away with whatever he wanted to. That's how I read it.
Interestingly, I had a trial against Brodsky's brother, who's a judge or with Brodsky's brother, who's actually a judge up in Lake County, and couldn't have been more of a nice gentleman and a great judge. And I had nothing but great experiences with him. But
wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, the article doesn't really get into too many details on what he did or did not do, so I'm going to have to look it up.
But you can look it up. You can
I was very interested
on the ARDC website. All of those complaints are always on there.
That's my homepage, actually, so I'll check it out later after the show.
I'm just going to read the topic, and I'm going to get out of the way. Feds want 81-year-old bank robbery suspect to return to prison.
Poor guy.
Well, actually,
not really poor guy.
Red from Shawshank.
Yeah.
Well, see, he has had a long line of other instances too. So,
well, okay, so let's take pity on the guy. So this guy is an 81-year-old man. I mean, granted, he seems like a bad character, but here's the story. So this 81-year-old man who spent a good chunk of his life in jail because he robbed a series of banks, was released from prison within the past couple of years. And then because he couldn't really make it work financially after he left prison, apparently his Social Security payments were $800 a month, and that wasn't enough for him to live. What he decided to do was to walk into a credit union in Tucson, Arizona in January, and actually didn't even bother to put a disguise on, and actually took a BB gun with him rather than a handgun, and laid it on the counter and demanded cash. And he really just almost like, you know, turned himself in the process of like trying to hold up this credit union. And so they're saying that he probably has Alzheimer's and is not fit to stand trial. But the whole reason why he did this was because he can't financially make it work, and he'd rather be back in prison where he will be able to sustain himself and he'll be taken care of, or at least better than he can take care of himself out of prison. So it's a sad story.
Well, just like Red Redding in Shawshank, he was institutionalized. And you see this commonly with people who have been in and out of the system for many years. They can't adjust to life outside, and they look for any reason to get back under the warm embrace of the penal system. That's how Michael and I met, right?
Yes, it is.
Sully's. Downstate. Was it Marion?
Yeah, those were good times. Yeah. I don't want to go back, but I mean, you know, I take pity on this guy for a different reason. As someone who worked as a banker for a bank, a large firm here in Chicago, there is not.
I'd have turned the money over right away.
I was going to say.
Any suspicious character got the money.
Even no a guy with a BB gun.
No questions asked.
Just take it.
Take it.
Well, it's funny you say that, because they often tell you that you're not supposed to mess with them. Just give them the money. And for somebody who has been in the room when a bank robbery happened but didn't see it happen, I was a few steps away from it. It's pretty quick. I mean, they just walk in, no disguise most of the time, and hand the note, and then you just give them, you know, 20s and get through it.
81-year-old could have old man strength. I mean, Sam, Phil Reagan, what's his name? Reagan is now the pitching coach for the Mets. He's
82.
Wow.
80 is the new 70.
Mean fastball, though.
Old man making a comeback on Legal Face-Off. Let's keep rolling here, because I think we're running up against it, Sam.
So the fifth topic involves U.S. soccer, namely the women's team, and there's they're mediating a gender discrimination lawsuit. A lot of lawsuits on the show today.
That's what we call Legal Face-Off.
What do you think this show's about, Sam? Yeah,
there's a theme.
That was sarcasm, Tina. Apparently your meter is broken.
So women, the U.S. soccer team, of course, are competing in the Women's World Cup. They are now, what, 2-0, I think, Sam? You are the.
I think they're 3-0.
Are they 3-0?
And they're going to semi.
They're the best team. They're doing
great. I mean, setting records for goals. And just last week, as Sam mentioned, they agreed to mediate this lawsuit that's been going on forever, that alleges that they're not being paid, not being treated the same as men, as their male counterparts, and that they should have less of a disparity. I think they're not asking for exact equal pay. Some of them are. But they are asking for, you know, a lot closer pay. They're asking for similar turf and similar conditions and similar resources than the men. On the other hand, I think what's interesting and what we have to, you know, realize without sounding politically incorrect is that male sports in this country and worldwide generate higher sums of revenue than female sports. And the difference in this example is FIFA, the governing body, sets aside a pool of $400 million for 32 men's teams versus $30 million for 24 women's teams. So just to make this Legal Face-Off, I'm going to throw it there. Should the pay for women and men in soccer be equal because we want an equal level playing field, or should there be a disparity based on the popularity of men's sports versus women's? Tina.
Well, I think you raise a really good point. I think the question we have to ask ourselves is, why is there that disparity in popularity? Is it an issue that, you know, the men's sports are more popular because they've been around longer? Is there more of an opportunity for people to see these sports, whether it's hearing them on the radio, seeing them on TV? Do they get more publicity? So, I mean, I'm all for taking a closer look at this and figuring out whether equal pay is warranted. But I think we also have to peel the onion further and say, okay, well, why are the men's sports more popular?
Guys, what do you think?
All I know is I really enjoyed watching high school soccer with my female counterparts. It was a great sport, and I agree with Tina. I mean, there needs to be a look into what's going on behind the scenes. And I have a quick question for everybody: is it the same companies that are the same organizations that are paying these athletes, male and female? There's not like two different types of governing bodies above both.
I think it's the same one company.
Well, then, yeah, they should be paid equally. I agree on that.
So just to counter the argument that they should be paid differently because of the different levels of popularity, Nina Chaudhry, who is the general counsel for the National Women's Law Center in Washington, said that, quote, these are the same kinds of arguments and claims that we still see at every level of education for women and girls from K through 12 to college. It's unfortunately a sad continuation of the way that women and girls in sports are treated in the U.S. And I think to Tina's point, some of this is institutional and maybe cannot be solved by litigation, but I think it's a pretty good start.
Well, all of this on top of it, though, from what I was looking up on these things, I don't know if there really is that much of a revenue difference between the men's sports and the women's sports when it comes to soccer in the U.S., only because I think their ratings are just about, if not better, than the men's team due to the fact that they are objectively a better team of soccer.
Yeah, I mean, so, can you name, I can name a bunch of female soccer players. I don't know if I can name any men on the U.S. team. So to your point,
I mean, I don't know if I can name any soccer true. Players.
And you think, they'd be on a level playing field being that it's the Olympics, right? I mean, it's not like comparing the Bulls of the sky. Tina, you brought up, you know, television and everything. Bulls play 82 games. How many are on TV? 82. The Sky play 34 games. They're on TV 20 times. So it's not really a level playing field. Two topics to go. Carrie Underwood and the NFL are being sued over a theme song for Sunday Night Football.
Yes, last week, a singer named Heidi Merrill filed a lawsuit in New York against Carrie Underwood based on the theme song for Sunday Night Football, which she started singing back in 2018. So the lawsuit alleges that Underwood's version of the song is very similar, if not identical, to Merrill's version of the song, which is actually under the same name. The claims are that Merrill, back in 2017, spoke to one of Underwood's producers about the possibility of using this song as the new theme for Sunday Night Football. And several months later, Underwood's assistant or producer's assistant said that they were going to take a pass on the song. And then the song got launched the following season. And people believe that there are striking similarities. So it's interesting. I don't know if you all did a side by side of the songs. It's pretty interesting.
Did you think they sounded same?
I thought they did. Stripping the lyrics aside, which obviously are different, I think that there's a lot of similarity.
And the title, right?
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, the title's exactly.
Game on. No, but I thought they were really similar. I mean, the beat is similar. Obviously, the theme is very similar. And if a jury believes her allegation, of course, that she was turned down by Carrie Underwood's people, then I think Carrie's going to have to pay up pretty significantly.
I wish you could have seen the look on Ben's face. He was trying to figure out where that noise was coming from. He was like, what is going on? Oh, Rich is
it's a very sophisticated legal face-off AV system we have where we're playing things through my phone. But
I thought he was just a big Meryl fan and rocking to the beat, to be honest.
Yeah.
She looks like, you know, she looks like she takes a lot of umbrage with this, but I think that she kind of corners the market as far as sports-related songs, because she also wrote a song in 2015 for the Nebraska football team called the Cornhusker Strong. Cornhusker Strong.
And weirdly, Carrie Underwood is suing her because she wrote her own version. Nebraska Strong. That's just a joke. But yeah, I mean, very similar songs. Mm-hmm. It made me look at some of the great, you know, copies in music history. We've covered a lot of those on our show. But
Ice Ice Baby was the first one that really entered my consciousness way back when.
Well, it segues great into our last story.
Did anybody see the Stones, by the way, here in Chicago? Anybody go?
No. Maybe two members of the OGs, Mike Heidemann and Rich Lenka. We were
quite possibly.
We were at the show Thursday, or what was it, Friday night?
It was Friday night.
Who remembers? It was kind of a blur.
There's still a couple of
cocktails were
had. How about Mick Jagger throwing daggers at Ed Burke, too? That was pretty something. But now the Stones have another legal battle on the horizon.
So more similarities between songs. The Verve, who remembers The Verve?
Going back I'm to, a huge Verve fan.
Yes. Back to the 90s, released in 1997. The Verve was a one-hit wonder.
It was not a one-hit wonder, at least not in Ireland.
They released a song called,
did they release?
Yeah.
They've had
Bittersweet
several
Symphony
albums.
Part 2.
Yeah.
But their song Bittersweet Symphony had a sample of the orchestral recording that is used in the Rolling Stones song from 1965. That song is called The Last Time. And they had permission, they had a license to use it, but Mick Jagger and Keith Richards alleged for many years that they went over the license. They used too much of that song. And as a result, after many, or they were involved in litigation for many, many years. And Mick Jagger and Keith Richards were actually given credit, songwriting credit for that song, just until last week when the lead singer of The Verve, Richard Ashcroft, tweeted that they have finally given up and they have agreed, Richards and Jagger have agreed to take their name off the song and have given up their right to further royalties from the song. Now, you know, they have now received 20 or so years of royalties from the song. It's been viewed 450 million times on YouTube. But Ashcroft has said he's happy that going forward, he will be able to be the sole writer of the song. He wasn't blaming Jagger and Richards. The license was actually owned by their former manager.
Well, and also, so I guess I may be the only Verve and Richard Ashcroft fan in the room. I'm a big fan of both.
Yep.
I think for him, it was really, as you mentioned, Rich, it wasn't so much about the money, especially now that we're 22 years off of when the song was recorded. It was much more about getting the honor of having, you know, a song that is still being sampled. It's still being used for commercials. I mean, Bittersweet Symphony is still in high rotation for such an old song.
Heidemann, you're a singer-songwriter.
Yeah.
Isn't all music copied in some respect from other music?
There are only so many ways and so many words you can put into a song and so many chords you can use. So I feel like the fact that the Rolling Stones manager or whomever held this just was being extremely unfair, because at the end of the day, songs are going to sound the same. You were mentioning the similarities of the songs in the previous story. Spirit and Led Zeppelin are still fighting over the start of Stairway to Heaven. It's going to be going on forever. I mean, just think about
Huey Lewis and Ray Parker Jr.
Still to this day. Right? Still to this day. So I think I give credit for him keeping up this battle, because that's what you need to do. If you're going to be an artist, at the end of the day, you want the credit. That's why the person with Game On came on, and this is why Richard Ashcroft is still staying.
All right, Matt, favorite Stone song. We got to end with our favorite Stone song.
Well, one thing I really want to know is how much revenue or how many royalties did this actually raise over the 20 plus years? I really want to know what a one-hit wonder. Sorry, but
probably a lot.
Favorite Stone. I'm also going to show you what my socks that I wore for Jagger Richards today. My British music socks.
Nice.
All right, favorite Stone song, Matt. Come on, you got to give us one.
You know when you guys get started, I'm really, really bad at tying a band with the name of a song. I'll know the songs.
Heidemann, you got plenty.
I do. My favorite Stone song, it has to be "Painted Black." One of the first songs I learned on the guitar, and
you kept asking for it Friday nights.
Yeah, because
Jagger finally heard you up in the 200 level and played it. Tina.
So I'm going to go with a song that probably no one else is going to name. Angie. Love Angie.
Oh, my God.
I think Angie's a great song. And Tori Amos's version is amazing.
All right, I'm a Tumbling Dice guy.
Me
forever.
Too. No way. Yes. Number one.
What a copycat, Sam.
Yeah, that's what I'm all about. Matt Pollack from the Chicago Volunteer Legal Services and the website CVLS.org. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Michael Heidemann, Steve Cochran Show for Rich, Tina, Ben. I'm Sam. We'll talk to you next time on Legal Faceoff.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Faceoff. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand.